Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we get to have Yoshihiro Kato. He's a founder of Caddy. Yoshihiro, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Jess.
So obviously, Caddy is having enormous success. Why don't we start with telling people what it does and who your typical customers are?
Of course. So Caddy is a manufacturing service and software for, of course, the manufacturing industry. Our mission is to unleash the potential of manufacturing, and we do basically two business units, two businesses. One is Caddy Manufacturing, which we originally started 7 years ago with. And Caddy Manufacturing is a procurement platform that kind of connects buyers and suppliers for custom-made parts. So how it works is basically our customers, like we have more than 1,000 manufacturing customers. They send us drawings, and our software analyzes the drawings and makes the quotation out of it. And we select the best suppliers out of the supplier network of 600 suppliers globally. And we do not really produce the parts, but they produce the parts. And we inspect the parts in our inspection centers, and we deliver the parts to the customer. So basically, it's kind of an Amazon for manufacturing industry for a custom-made parts field. It's Caddy Manufacturing, and we have also a Caddy Drawer, which is a drawing search software to capitalize on your customer's historical drawings and supply chain data. So Drawer, what it does is to, you know, Drawer automatically analyzes historical 2D drawings, even handwritten ones, and within a second, so that people can really leverage the data in the past. Not just by, or you know, so that they can search drawings, not just by keywords, but by shapes and images, and leverage those data for future use. So we have our patented technology to do similarity search with AI, which is very unique. So those are the two pillars of our business. And again, our mission is to unleash the potential of manufacturing by doing two businesses.
Yeah. You know, I was watching a bunch of your YouTube videos, and it was interesting to like these demos where it's like somebody is searching, hey, what about this part? And the AI just like cycles through all their old drawings and realize, oh, we've already been buying that part, but it's like 30% cheaper over here. Let's not overpay for it. And like, it was interesting, these like instant efficiency gains that like normally somebody in procurement wouldn't recognize, right? Because there's just too much stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens in the market is that there are a lot of, especially in what we call high mix, low volume industries, like non-mass production industries, equipment manufacturers or rail car makers or aerospace manufacturing industries. They create a lot of different drawings, but a lot of them are very similar to the drawings they have in the past. But engineers do not really know the existence of similar drawings in the past because there's no tool to do that. So basically, they just recreate drawings again and again. And of course, so then there are a lot of similar drawings in the archive. But procurement people kind of redo their negotiation process and RFQ process again and again with their suppliers or new suppliers. That leads to, you know, price inconsistencies that you mentioned. So what we see from our customers is that they buy a lot of similar parts, but the price is so different, regardless of the timing. And of course, in the like recent 2 years, 3 years, they are facing supply chain issues, which of course caused them a price increase for their materials and so on. But regardless of the timing, they have a lot of fluctuations on the similar drawings. So in terms of cost, so Drawer with Drawer, you can identify the cost, you know, fluctuations, and then leveraging those data, you can renegotiate with the suppliers and drive the cost down. So that's, you know, one of the use cases, tons of use cases, but that's one of the most powerful use cases we have.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially in big bureaucracies, right? Where people in this department know what people in that department did. Well, I'm interested, as far as I know, I don't think you guys are announcing what your valuation of the company is, but what I heard of the guess is in the hundreds of millions. I'm interested, your time at McKinsey and your co-founder's time at Google and Apple, what do you think you brought from those experiences as you guys built this business?
Yeah, it's a little long story, but actually before McKinsey, I was at at the University of Tokyo. I was I had my own business, and that's when I got really immersed in the business field, business development, and kind of entrepreneurship. So I decided to continue to do this like entrepreneurship kind of thing, but I wanted to, of course, devote my life to like something bigger. So, but I didn't have any idea on what is happening in the like traditional markets. So I kind of set three criterias when it comes to what kind of businesses I want to do. Right, one is big market, and the second one is like deeper pain points or like huge pain points that the market has. And three, the third one is like global commonality. I actually chose McKinsey to really find the issues in the traditional markets, that fits those criteria. And then, so I did a lot of industries. I did a lot of what we call practices, which are like strategy, marketing, sales, procurement, all those like functions. And I found manufacturing and procurement very, very interesting because, of course, the market is the biggest. And there are a lot of manual processes. There's so many room for improvement. And also, it's globally common, right? I was working for McKinsey in Japan, the US, Netherlands, and China. And all the manufacturers, like large enterprises, have the same problem, right? So, of course, I've learned a lot of problem-solving skills at McKinsey, or documenting, skills and so on. But the biggest learning I got from McKinsey's experience is that the pain points that a lot of manufacturers have. And in terms of Aki, who is a co-founder of Caddy, he used to work for Apple and Lockheed Martin in the US. He's a nerd, or like, he's a geek, right? No, he is really a tech guy. So we decided to, found this company 8 years ago. And of course, he tested a lot of technical side of things. And I had a lot of hypothesis on, how can we make the manufacturing industry better by using technologies. So those are this is the kind of storyline made us, here.
Yeah. And you're based in Chicago now, is that right?
Yes, I'm in Chicago now.
And then what countries do you operate in?
So we have five countries in operations, the US, Mexico, Japan, Thailand, and Vietnam, the five countries. Yes.
By the way, I really like your list. I want to go after huge industry, huge market, deep pain point, and something that works globally in other countries too. Like I really like that recipe.
Yeah, I mean, I love developing new businesses, but of course, in the end, what I want to do is to make an impact on the world scale, right? So, of course, if we focus on really smaller topics, then we could probably exit, within 3 years with, I don't know, $10 million. But that's not something I'm very interested in. So I was looking for a topic that, excites me for 20, 30 years. And that's why, I set those criteria.
Yeah. I know I've read that you have a little bit of a background in lean, and I grew up super enamored with Japan. I did martial arts all my growing up years, and then competitive judo in my high school years and stuff.
Oh, really?
And I finally got to go. I went and did the Toyota production tour. Toyota production system tours, at Toyota, Nissan, and a bunch of the suppliers in Nagoya and stuff like that. It was amazing. My favorite thing though was all the Japanese feudal architecture. That's my favorite. But what advantages do you think you've had growing up in Japan and now building such a dominant business both here in the US and globally?
That's a good question. I don't know if this is Japan thing, because the only company I work for was McKinsey, which is a global company headquarters in the US, right? So I don't have a kind of like typical Japanese company experience, but of course, like manufacturing, at least like 30 years ago, Japan has the one of the biggest GDP. Of course, now it's the third in the in their third position. So it's still big, but the manufacturing is the core of our economic growth, at least like from like 50 years ago to 20 years ago. So of course, there are a lot of terminologies that are used globally that you said, Kanban or Kaizen, whatever, right? I don't know if I have this kind of spirit because I've never worked for Japanese manufacturing companies. But we started 7 years ago working with a lot of Japanese companies, and Japanese economy is really stagnated. You know, it's been flat for the last 30 years. It's been said lost 30 years in Japan, right? In 1985, 32 companies are in the global top 50, you know, companies list, including Toyota, Honda, or financial companies, whatever. But now it's only Toyota in the list of 50 biggest companies in the world, right?
Yeah.
But the good thing about it, it's not really good, but a good thing about it for us is that they really focus on cost reduction for the last 30 years because there's no upside, right? For them, at least they didn't experience a lot of growth. So they needed to focus on a lot of cost reductions, which made the operations and procurement really, really, really strong in a positive way and negative way. So I learned a lot from Japanese operations in their factories. And also procurement operations as well. You know, they're really good at analyzing cost and, you know, what we call should cost analysis and value engineering and value analysis, that kind of analysis to really streamline their operations and cost procurement processes.
Yeah.
So again, it's based on the last 30 years history. So it's not necessarily good or great, but at the same time, you know, we provided a lot of parts to Japanese manufacturers, and their standard is so high, right? You know, cost should be super, you know, inexpensive, and quality should be 99.9995% or something, right?
Yeah.
So that's why now we are operating in the U.S., Mexico, Thailand, and Vietnam. We are really leveraging what we learned from Japan market in terms of manufacturing. So that's something. It's good.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I grew up in Canada, and I feel like, you know, I had nothing about like working for Canadian businesses, but I feel like one of the advantages, Canadians are just known for being like polite and friendly.
Yeah.
And like, even though I have friends and cousins and stuff in the US, my growing up years, and I'm technically an American born abroad, like, I do feel like that's like a power from Canada's. Canadians are interested in having more fun. Like they laugh more than Americans. And they're known to be like a little more polite or a little more, right? And then like, I feel like that totally goes in my favor, just growing up Canadian, of like, you know, maybe a little easier to make friends or people, you know, like me for some of those reasons.
That's great.
What about just growing up Japanese? What did, like, I was thinking we had a, you know, CEO who grew a billion-dollar company or Treasure Data, you know, grew up in Japan, came over here, built billion-dollar business. What about like Japanese culture from your parents or anything that you feel like is an advantage when you have to compete against Americans?
I don't know. But of course, like, you know, we are said, at least we are really diligent. Last week I talked to one person from manufacturing industry. He said, Americans work full life. And Japanese people, their life is for work. I don't know if this is good, right? Especially in this generation where a lot of people, you know, putting importance on their life than you know, work, which is a little frustrating to me. But I'm probably too old.
Yeah.
I don't know. But in terms of mentality, but yeah, I mean, they really like, you know, 5S or the Kaizen process. They are really, really detail oriented. So that's. You know, sometimes you need that kind of mentality, you know, when it comes to business development, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like a couple of things is like, I feel like there's such a pursuit of excellence that it, as a like cultural theme. But the other one too is I feel like a lot of, you know, Canadian, American, other countries could learn from more of a sense of community. Like, I think that our more individualistic approaches to things have a certain benefits, but also certain negatives, where there is like more responsibility for the group instead of, you know, like sometimes my Canadian or American friends, cousins, and myself, like there can be more me, 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 where I think some of this, like, I just remember on my trip over there, like really getting this sense of like the sense of stewardship for everybody in the company and this, I don't know, sense of duty to more than just yourself. And I feel like we could learn from that. I don't know if you feel similarly.
Yeah. We really put importance on harmony. So it's sometimes really positive. It's sometimes really negative because people do not want to confront with other people, right? Or dispute with other people. So in the business world, of course, you want to disagree. Yeah, you need to disagree, you know, if you disagree, right? With even if it's with your bosses or supervisors. But so it's pros and cons, but yes, collaboration, harmony, all those things, that is a kind of, you know, positive part of Japan.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have a lot of founders and CEOs who listen to the show. If you had advice, let's talk about some success secrets here. If you had advice for new client acquisition for somebody else who wants to grow a company worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, what's some advice?
That's a good question. So first of all, that like common mistakes or pitfalls for entrepreneurs, I think is, it's like commonly said, but people tend to start from solutions rather than problems. So problems are not right, of course, solution will never be right. Right. A lot of cases, oftentimes that, you know, the problems are not really there. But you believe that our entrepreneurs believe that problem is there and there's a huge, you know, fancy solution to solve that. So one of the kind of principles I have is, you know, if you want to create a new business, you know, you need to really judge whether the problem you're solving is in the list of top three problems that your target prospects have in their life, right? Is that really a pain point, really a pain point or headache for them that really they need to solve right now, right? So that's the kind of thing I would start. For example, in our case, we started, so our name Caddy is from like two different meanings, but one of them is CAD data, so CAD direct sourcing from 3D CAD. So we actually focused on 3D CAD before we start our own company, because 3D CAD is more, I would say, technical and machine readable than 2D CAD or 2D drawings or papers. And there are a lot of new technologies around 3D CAD, but actually like it's kind of solution side or technology side, right? Or C side. But actually, after we get like 100 inquiries from our potential customers through our network and internet, or I mean like a website, we realized that nobody out of the 100 people used 3D format when they source parts, right? When they procure parts. So, you know, we thought, oh, probably we are addressing a wrong problem. And procurement people do not really use 3D CAD for their sourcing. So why don't we just focus on 2D drawings, which are not really fancy? You know, a lot of we've got a lot of papers actually, literally like delivered our DMs and fax and emails, whatever, with, you know, 2D formats. But that's what they are using, right? In supply chain side, at least. So we changed our focus from 3D CAD related technology development to 2D drawings or papers analysis. And that's actually that's been working really well, because in the end, we realized that more than 95% of the procurement people use 2D format than 3D format. So if there are a lot of companies that are really focusing on 3D technologies, which is good, but it doesn't necessarily solve the current problems that the ordinary procurement people have. So, you know, you should always start from issues or pain points or challenges in the market rather than solutions.
Yeah, so let's go a little further on that. So let's say that we are, you know, we are confident, we've done that exercise, and this is genuinely starting pain point first and reverse engineering. Like, I had this famous author on the show, Seth Godin. He said, don't find customers for your product, find products for your customer. Like, choose the customer first and figure out the product, right? So if founder listening is confident they've done that, even if they could continue to improve it, what's another next step of like, okay, you know, we've got something that is very pain point specific. What's something that you think separates folks who maybe have figured that out, but they only build a small company versus the ones that build a giant company?
Yeah. So you should not think about the scaling up your company first. You should really focus on solving that issue that you found, right? So, you know, there are a lot of fancy marketing hacks and technologies out there. Of course, we are using a lot of technologies now, but before, like in the first year, we actually used a lot of like, you know, phones and emails. That's it. And also my network, right? So in the first company that ordered to us was a large manufacturer that I worked with, you know, at last at McKinsey. So, you know, I just leveraged my network. So in the US, of course, like we started this business in the US like several years ago, 2 years ago, we didn't have any kind of network, a lot of network. We didn't have any like marketing tricks and like contents in the US. So what we did is to send some gifts to the customers and then just call them. I sent this gift, and one of the gifts we sent out is actually a box of champagne and box of Japanese whiskey. And, you know, we sent this to the CEO of, like, you know, I don't know, $100 million manufacturing equipment manufacturer, right? And they pick up the phone and said, oh, you are the one who sent us the bomb, right? So that's the reaction, but, you know, that's when we can start conversations with them, right? I don't know if that was successful. We've got some customers out of that approach, actually, but we stopped that we got some tractions. But, you know, leverage whatever you have within your network or within your like brain. You know, you don't have to focus on scalability of the approach. You should really focus on and one, you know, one customer that you want to really reach out to.
Yeah. By the way, I don't know anything about Japanese whiskey except that it's a big deal. What's like the best brands of Japanese whiskey?
I honestly, I'm not really familiar with Japanese whiskey either. But I knew that Japanese whiskey is really getting more popular in the US. So that's why, you know, we sent out, one brand from Suntory, which is the most famous Japanese brand, but I'm not really familiar with that. I like wine. I like champagne. I know a little bit about champagne and wine, but you know, one of the marketing members said, "Why don't we leverage Japanese thing? You know, Japanese whiskey." Yeah. So and why not?
Super cool. What's another success secret for founders? What's something that you learned by doing it that maybe wasn't just in the business books or your business school?
It's probably in the business school book or whatever. But of course, building up your culture and organization is super important. It's, I would say, for the long term, probably it's more important than business development for the short term. We have around 600 people globally, and I've been doing all the final work, what we call work sample, but like kind of an in case interview with all the candidates, all the members we hired. So like more than, I don't know, I've done like more than 3,000, 4,000 interviews so far. I clearly remember like in 2022, we grew from 200 to 300 people to 500, 600. And in the last week of December in 2022, I got 83 interviews in 1 week. So like all of them have more than 30 minutes, right? So it was really intensive. I was about to quit this kind of, you know, final interviews, but it's really working well, right? Because I can, of course, I'm the one who can really talk about where we are coming from and why we, you know, what we value, and why we value them, and what we are struggling with, and why you, you know, why we want to work with you, right? And so we should be, or companies should be very selective. It's been tough. I mean, in the US, I've done more than like 100, 200 interviews in the first, I don't know, 2-3 months. And we've got just like one person. And that was really tough. HR person said, no, you are the bottleneck. I asked him, or actually her, I asked her, you know, how can we boost this? And she said, you know, if you don't have you, the hiring activities will be boosted. And that is right. But, you know, like Jeff Bezos said, we need bar raiser, right? You know, it's really easy to lower the bar, but it's very important to keep the bar high, or, you know, raise the bar continuously. So that's the kind of, you know, tips or principles I have in terms of organizational development.
Yeah. So let's say you have somebody that gets through the team and they get to you and you're realizing they're not a fit. What are the kind of things that you're saying? Like, obviously they've checked enough boxes that they're getting to you for a final interview. If you're saying no at that final interview, what are the kind of things you're saying no to?
So of course we check their skill set, but skill set and experience is the last thing I would check actually. The most important thing for us is what we call culture fit and mission fit and value fit. So, so we are really chaotic, right? So, of course if they are committed, if they're, really determined, and yeah, so there are a lot of things, I see, and my brain is working like an AI now. So, you know, if I talk to somebody like within, you know, for 15 seconds, I quickly, you know, can judge whether they fit with our company or not. But so now, you know, people ask me, you know, why, right? Why you pass on them? And I need to verbalize my criteria now. But the biggest thing is culture fit, and if they really fit with our culture and values, that's it.
Yeah. What do you feel like are some of the advantages of having at least met all 600 of these employees, right, when you approve them?
What do you mean?
What are advantages to the business? I mean, that's obviously something that's less common for a CEO, especially once you started getting into the hundreds of employees. So what are some of the other advantages of having been a part of the hiring of all these people that you see?
The advantages of having me in the process, or...
Yeah. What are the advantages to the company of having you in the process instead of just letting HR or some manager do it without you?
I mean, yeah, obviously we have better conversion rate, what we call conversion rate from offer to acceptance. Because of course, if you want to work for a startup, you want to know more about the founders, right? So of course, if I'm on the final stage, candidates tend to be more attracted, right? Sometimes they, I don't know, but you know, sometimes they tend to be attracted. So that's one benefit obviously we have. And also, they know me, right, before joining Caddy. So oftentimes they invite me for a dinner, group dinner, But they we have a closer relationship with the candidates from day zero or day one. That's also a benefit. Of course, I don't know if we can continue this for 5 years from now. But at least if we have a strong team with 500 people, 1,000 people, I think we can scale this up to 10,000 people or 100,000 people. So yeah, I mean, the relationship with the employees is super important for me.
Yeah. What kind of things, thinking that you may end up hiring 10,000 or 100,000 people over time, what kind of things do you do now so that you won't have to reinvent things later? When you think about the company at the stage it's at, what are you doing to prepare to make that potential kind of growth less painful than it could be?
Of course, I need to, I'll say the thing that is the other way around, but I need to, of course, nurture and grow people who can do the, who can be the final, bar raiser, right? Because, of course, probably, I love the story that Elon Musk said. I don't know if this is correct, if this is true, but Elon Musk, he said he did all the final interviews at SpaceX until it gets 3,000 people. So I know I can do that until 3,000 people because it's proved, it's proven. But probably 10,000, probably it's almost impossible. So of course I need to raise, grow people. I need to tell them what is really important for us. And so that's the thing, of course, I'm working on now. For example, one and a half years ago, I took maternity leave. Parental leave when I got at the first kid, and of course someone needed to do the final interview. Actually, I did a video check. We recorded the video of the interviews. Of course, after getting permissions from them, and I did some gave some feedback to the final interviewers who are at VP or GM level, that kind of process is super important to really scale up the business.
Yeah. Interesting. And have you guys bootstrapped or fundraised, or what's been your capital?
$160-170 million.
Yeah. When you think about fundraising, there's so many people with competing opinions about how to do it. What's a secret? What's something that worked for you raising, $170 million?
It's actually, there's no secret, there's no secret source, that you can leverage, but it's very probably normal. But I think there are three, four, very important things. One is, very similar to my criteria, but big markets, right? If you want to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, you need to, get it back at, $1 billion at least, or several $1 billion. Right. So, of course, you need to have that level of market. So big TAM, total addressable market. This is one thing. And also product market fit. So if the solution or product you have really solves the problems, that, yeah.
Can I ask about that? I actually love asking billion-dollar founders and founders and got, into the hundreds of millions. How do you define product market fit?
Yeah, that's the question I really hate the most. But it's really, really a challenging question. But there are several things. For example, when we launched Drawer 2 years ago, we set some criteria for product market fit. Product market fit is not a one-off thing, right? You need to prove product market fit in each and every category or segment or industry or department. But what we said 1.5 years ago, 2 years ago, was one, churn rate, and two, NPS. So basically customer satisfaction. If the first 10, 20, 30 customers, if they are really, really satisfied with the product, and if they really, really want to continue to use it. Or I forgot the name, Sean Ellis test, which is to ask, how painful are you, will it be if you don't have that product? So you do not really directly ask the satisfaction. You just ask, you know, if they can really tolerate if there's no product, you know, if there's, you know, if you don't have a drawer, you know, in front of you. So
I like that. Who came up with that? Sean Ellis?
You know, Sean Ellis? I don't know. Probably Sean Ellis came up with that. That's why.
That's so great. How painful would it be if this product wasn't available anymore?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great test. And there's a kind of benchmark scores, right? You can leverage. We use that metrics. And of course, growth numbers, right? ARR growth and customer acquisitions and CV, conversion rates, CVRs, and so on. But for me, the most important metric is customer satisfaction rather than growth. Because growth, you can make it, right? If you just spread it with monetary incentives, for example. But if whether customers are satisfied or not, you cannot really control it intentionally. So that's the metrics I watched, at least.
Well, and probably more important for the long term of a business, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So NRR, net revenue retention, is also important criteria for us now. It's probably, you know, for the first year, it's probably too early to implement that criteria. But net revenue retention or net dollar retention is also a really key important criteria to judge, you know, if whether customers are really, really satisfied and they're willing to upgrade the contract.
Yeah. So if when you're measuring this, when you do get an answer that somebody isn't as satisfied or a group of customers aren't as satisfied as you feel like they could be, what's your decision tree look like? What are the kind of tactics? What are the kind of choices you're making at that point to try to do a better job?
Yeah. So we have a strategy or at least hypothetical strategy to, you know, who are the customers we need to really satisfy first. We actually judge the satisfaction rate and weekly active users, like WAU, for two groups. One is the target group, and the other one is non-target group. And we actually kind of ignore the satisfaction rate in the second group, because we are really intentionally targeting the first group. For example, 2 years ago, we intentionally really focused on procurement officers. So there were a lot of other functions, departments using Drawer, like engineering, of course. They use a lot of drawings, or manufacturing, quality, sales, after sales. But we just watched the KPIs, or sorry, metrics for procurement officers. And as long as they are satisfied, that's fine. Of course, there are a lot of feedbacks from engineers. And for example, like we want to use 3D CAD. We want to have, I don't know, design review process related functions, whatever. But we intentionally focused on procurement and then gradually expanded the focus to like engineers and so on. So,
yeah, like what did procurement officers want?
Cost reduction is the biggest thing that they want, of course. So we really focused on, again, pricing inconsistencies, identification kind of related functions so that procurement officers can really easily negotiate with their suppliers and they can really identify the best pricing for each and every part really easily. And also our procurement officers do supplier consolidation because oftentimes they, like different procurement officers, over the course of years, they use a lot of different suppliers for very similar parts. So what they want to do is to consolidate all those different suppliers to one or two suppliers to really increase the volume and drive the cost down. So anyways, you know, they want to reduce the cost. So we focus on, you know, how can we make sure that Drawer helps them to reduce the cost.
That's great. Well, if people want to learn more or connect with you on social media, like what's the website and are you on LinkedIn or where's the best places?
Yeah, of course you can find me or us on LinkedIn. You can Google Caddy Drawer or Caddy, CADDI Drawer, like Drawer. You can find it. And please contact us if you are interested.
That's great. Well, what do you want to leave people with today?
I mean, it depends on the audience. If you're an entrepreneur, again, you should really focus on problems. And that's the most common mistakes that entrepreneurs tend to have. If you are related to manufacturing, please contact us, reach out to us, and let's talk about more details, about the services and, what we can provide.
That's great. Well, thanks for making time to do this.
Thank you, Zess. That was, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Okay. Bye, everyone.